Evening. Austin Williams, welcome to Outward Unleashed. How are you, sir?
Not bad at all, mate. How are you?
Yeah, good. Thank you very much for asking. Maybe you could just start by letting our viewers know what it is you do. What keeps you busy?
I'll just take that out for a second. I run the Future Cities Project, which is a kind of a think tank, which is looking at urban development. But I'm really in my day job. I teach architecture to students who don't want to be taught about architecture. So it's, you know, it's one of those great struggles in life. That's what I do. But the Future Cities Project is probably more about what my interests lie, just trying to understand what's going on with urban development and why and across the world. So it kind of it opens up a whole new avenue of inquiry, which is a bit more limited when you're dealing in academia, especially given the collapse of academia in this country.
Right. So what is going on with urban development then?
there's that conversation about, there was a discussion, I suppose, after the Second World War about building more cities. And housing people and all the rest of it. Whereas, you know, in the UK, we haven't built a new city since 1975. America builds these kind of quite small scale townscapes. And of course, then in China, we see this kind of this idea that they are building and we aren't. And part of that is the fact that China doesn't exactly have the same level of democratic planning engagement that we do in the West. So we can just ride roughshod over people's lives. But at the same time, if you look at the data, that there's a lot of hype about China's development and how they're building cities. Whereas in fact, they're still impressive. They're expanding the cities, existing cities, and they're building out into the farmland. But in terms of building brand new cities, there's only been about four or five brand new cities constructed in China, which is no small feat, like I say, given the fact that we haven't done anything in this country for a long time. So in China, probably when Mao died, as a great benchmark moment, mid-1970s, there was about 200 cities in China, and now there's 700 cities. But that's partly a classification issue, where you call somewhere a city, just by naming it makes it so in China. So that's part of the game.
Okay, and I suspect a lot of this is part of perhaps the Chinese propaganda in the sense of how they want to be perceived by the rest of the world.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the hard part, isn't it? It's like there's information that we can try to understand about what's going on in China, while at the same time, you also have to suggest that maybe a lot of the stats are dubious and should be taken with a pinch of salt. So it's very difficult, really, to get a handle on it. But I did write a book about Chinese urbanism a few years ago, which was taking a look at the way that China has developed its kind of urban environment. And in some ways, it was that model, you know, this is a They've compressed 150 years of development that we've had in Britain or in America into maybe 50 years. So, you know, they've just kind of gone for broke. So they've built lots and lots of really crap kind of urban expansion. They've got really bad sense about, you know, what is a nice place to live, because that wasn't part of the agenda. They just wanted to encourage more people to come to the city, increase their productive capacity, develop their kind of commercial sector or whatever it might be, raise the economy. So that they pushed for growth, which had, you know, once you do that, it becomes like an engineering project rather than an architectural project. So lots of very naff cities. And it's only in the last 10 years they started playing around with maybe having some half-decent buildings and architecture. Once you reach a certain point in development, when you think, you know, we've now housed everybody, we now have a dynamic economy, now maybe let's give them a decent place to live. It's a shame it's a secondary consideration, but that's the way that it's happened in the West. You can see that in Chicago, in New York, in London. That's what always has happened throughout history, you know.
Well, talking of naff cities then, I mean, how important is aesthetics, I suppose, in terms of our living environment? Because I often see a lot of people pulling out comparisons of old architecture from 30 years ago and saying, you know, this is what this area used to look like. It was glorious. And now it's been replaced with this kind of modern concrete, drab looking, depressing, kind of oppressive environment almost. What do you have strong opinions on this kind of thing?
I think it's driven by a general mood in society, isn't it? Because if you looked at a lot of those criticisms about, you know, concrete slab developments and mass housing in the West, not just in Asia, but if you when that was happening post-war, this was rebuilding, giving fantastically new opportunities for people to move out of their slums, come back from the war, homes for heroes. And that idea that, you know, we were going to now, instead of living in a terrible terraced house with an outside toilet, which is what, you know, what happened in the 1930s, as it happens, it continued up to the 60s, funnily enough. But, you know, lots of terrible, terrible housing. You say, right, let's give them a high-rise building where they can maintain their community. We'll give them brand new cupboards. They'll have indoor plumbing. They'll have kitchens with gas stoves. You know, unheard of. So these were like miraculous interventions. People actually loved them. And you look back at the old Pathé newsreels, and, you know, people were excited by the prospect. Unfortunately, obviously, what happened was is that they put lots of poor people in them who never had any jobs, and the whole thing just basically crumbled as a social experiment, because you know they weren't being maintained by the local authorities or something like that. So a lot of those things have not really worked out in the way that it was envisaged. But all I'm saying is that if you have an excited moment in history, then you know you can what you do to manifest itself in that moment can be appreciated. Today we're living in a fairly miserablest climate where, you know, the future is a bleak place to be. We're all going to die, you know, under 10 feet of water or whatever the new scare is. Then obviously the future becomes somewhere we are trepidatious about, and we look back to the past as some kind of something to cling onto. So I think it's more of a mindset than a reality is all I'm trying to say.
Well, we're hearing a lot in the news, and this comes around every election cycle as well, and has done for a while, you know, the housing crisis in England and the UK. And do you give much thought to this? How serious is this issue to you? And do we have a hope of tackling it in an effective manner?
Well, it should do, shouldn't we? I always find it remarkable that the high point of house building in Britain was 1968. Where we had like 450,000 houses built every year. Now we're down to 250, if you're lucky, 220 last year. So it's halved. So, you know, we have all this fantastic new innovation. We have computers, we have 3D printing, we have, you know, super duper new training for workers and for consultants. And yet we can't actually handle building more housing. So in some ways, I think this is my own personal opinion. I think that it needs to have some level of intervention where there's a demand for shaking up the industry. I mean, we're still building houses by putting one brick on top of another brick with some, you know, soggy mortar in between. And we were doing that 5,000 years ago. Whereas now there is a possibility for mechanization, for fabrication, for prefabrication, 3D printing, as I say. You know, there's a world out there which should give us the opportunities to do something, but we're not seizing it, partly because there's an industry that doesn't want to change, because obviously that's going to lead to a lot of kind of job losses, but also the fact that, you know, we don't really have the innovative mindset that looks to the future as a good place to be. We look to the future as a potentially terrible place to be, and we don't want to get there. So everything is constraining our ambitions and our innovation, I think.
How healthy is the construction sector at the moment? I mean, are there, you know, potential risk for collapse in that sector?
Metaphorically speaking, collapse. I think that, there's a problem. Right. There's a problem because obviously roughly one third of housing stock in the UK is pre-First World War. One third is kind of mid-century, and the remaining third is post-1980 kind of thing. So obviously the very old stock is crumbling, and there's no scope for replacing it, or there should be, but there isn't. And some of the new stuff isn't very well made either. But a lot of contractors are going bankrupt, going broke. A couple of people who've invested in new, what they call modern methods of construction, which is this kind of prefabricated fabrication techniques, are also going broke because there's no investment in that sector yet. So that's on one side. Second thing is that there's less of a conversation about the housing crisis. So I agree with you that we need to build more houses. There is more and more people coming into the country. There's a significant problem of homelessness. And you would have thought that that would be top of the agenda in the conversation. But if you go to any architecture conference, let me tell you, anywhere in Britain, then top of the tree will be climate change and how we can reduce our, you know, carbon emissions. And net zero is the entire debate. There's no real kind of material conversation. It's a much more ethereal one. So we always discuss, you know, what we're going to build, how we're going to build, where we're going to build, but we never discuss, you know, whether we're going to build. And as a result, we don't actually build much. So, like I say, housing is half what it was 50 years ago.
So we have a huge problem as well that a lot of, you know, younger generations, generations younger than me, just don't really have a hope in hell of getting on the property ladder, given prices and the way the economy's changed in comparison to maybe their, you know, parents or grandparents' experience.
Well, that's true. But I mean, I think it's probably overblown. I mean, I didn't buy my first house till I was 32. Not that I necessarily lived at home all the time. I mean, there's a problem with young people not leaving home, which is more of a symbolic kind of tragedy for their own development and their own autonomy. They want to stay within the apron strings. But I do think, you know, young people have been a bit mollycoddled to a large extent. And, you know, you have to take the rough with the smooth. I agree with you that maybe they can't afford to buy a house in London. I can't afford to buy a house in London. So, you know, tell me something new. But, you know, maybe you have to live outside and you have to commute. But, of course, now we're living in a world where if you live outside London, you don't commute. You just have a Zoom call. So most of my students, well, not most, many of my students don't turn up. They want me to Zoom them and have a lecture online. And I tell them to get lost. They have to come in if they want to hear my lecture. I'm a bit old school. But, I mean, I think that it's a problem. If people perceive that they don't have to leave their bedsit in order to, you know, learn something or get an experience, that then constrains everything about their lives. And they, you know, that's where the fear comes in, that you feel put upon on every side. And I think that that's not exactly true.
What, in your mind, then, in terms of China, would you lead you to believe, but think that, you know, the economic rise might be a potential stall at the moment, and things have slowed down in that sense?
Well, I mean, in terms of the GDP, it's kind of stalled. I mean, at the high point, we can look back at the halcyon days of China when there was like 14-15% GDP percentage every year. Now it's down to, they said, around 5%, which is the first time that China has ever said around anything. They normally make a definitive statement so they can be held to account, whereas this time, you know, they can't even make 5%. And that's, like we said at the very beginning, that's based on the idea that we have to doubt their stats anyway. So the GDP declining, the property sector took a massive hit with, I don't know if you know Evergrande, which is a big housing developer in China. They went bankrupt. They were on the verge of bankruptcy for a long time, but they went bankrupt 2 years ago with a debts of $300 billion, which really kind of decimates the entire industry. It means the housing market has collapsed. Everybody in China, 50% of people in China own two homes. Could they use it as an investment and a pension for later life? That market has now collapsed. People are saving. China wants to invest in the consumer economy and get more people buying, you know, Chinese-made goods, but of course nobody's buying them because they're just holding on to the money. Add on to that the way that they handled COVID lockdown, and people are nervous about the Chinese state, you know, shutting them down again. So, you know, everything is conspiring against a kind of a more of a, I don't know, more free and easy kind of environment in China. But yeah, the housing sector will have long-term implications outside China as well, and its implications. I think HSBC took an 80% profit hit when Evergrande went under, because they had a major share investment in Evergrande. So and they've recovered slightly since. But do you know what I mean? So these things have repercussions, which we're yet to find out long-term.
Yeah. And in terms of the expedience with which, obviously, the Chinese can get, you know, development up and running, obviously, they've got the labour force there. Is there an aspect to it as well of, you know, very few regulations or not as regulated or as invested in health and safety as perhaps the West is? I think, to my mind, every time I tend to see some catastrophic construction failure video going viral. It invariably tends to be located in China. And I just wanted to get your opinion on that in terms of the, you know, construction methods, safety, things like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm always surprised that most things stand up in China, given the way that they're actually put together. No, I mean, because when I first went to China in 2011, it was a part of their building boom, and it was quite horrific to see what was going on, partly because, like, I was in a place called Suzhou, which is just outside Shanghai, and they'd basically, you know, kicked off thousands of farmers off their land to build this new extension of the city to house about 1 million people. And but then they converted many of the farmers into laborers. So, like, at the drop of a hat, you were a farmer, now put this hard hat on and these tough boots and get up the ladder. And that idea that, you know, they could somehow transform themselves with very little training and zero health and safety conversation was actually quite frightening. And of course, many, many, many thousands of people die on construction sites in China every year. So for me, I was an architect. I left architecture 20 years ago because the health and safety policies were coming in and bureaucratizing the entire profession. So everything was about form filling and tick boxing and this nonsense. And, you know, the whole profession just kind of lost its gloss for me. But then when you go to China and you see what a society without health and safety is like, you think, hang on a minute, there's a happy balance here, right, between those two. So to see, like, you know, 70-year-old women carrying steel reinforcing bars 40 stories up in the air. I went to Suzhou when they were building this brand new tower, which had this kind of archway, and it's about 60 stories up in the air. I was walking across, and there's a piece of plywood which I kicked, and it was a gap of about 2 feet, what's that, 600 millimeters, straight down 60 stories. So yeah, you did think, you know, excuse me, has somebody got a red flag to kind of point this out to ordinary workers? But anyway, they're kind of learning the hard way, you could say. And at that time, it was a rapid development. Yes, that's what it was about. Just build. Let's have a new economy. We want to be a global player, and we have to do whatever we have to do to get there. Now, like I say, they're kind of easing down a bit. The problem for China now, I suppose, is that because of all the things we've just talked about, including lockdown and people, you know, migrant laborers who they bring in from the inland areas to the eastern seaboard and the coastal areas, Shenzhen, Shanghai, and all that, those people are now determined. There's 300 million of them. About 50 million have decided not to come back, because they are the ones that really suffered, well, from terrible wages, but they also suffered from lockdown when they arrived, you know, in Shenzhen expecting to start their kind of crappy jobs and realized there weren't any jobs. They were all shut and they were locked out and they were sleeping in the streets. So people have learned, you know, very shocking lessons from the way China has behaved in the last couple of years. But that's having an impact then on what is Shenzhen. If Shenzhen is not the workshop of the world, then what is it? How can it reinvent itself? China's going through a big existential crisis, I think, at the moment.
What took you to China then? I mean, why did you visit? How long did you stay there for? What was your interest in China?
I had no interest in China. I was working quite happily for the Royal Institute of British Architects, writing books. That's what my job was. And my wife sent me an email saying they're starting a new university in China for architects. You should apply. So I applied and I stayed for 6 years. My wife was a little bit annoyed, but, you know, what can you do? But she stayed here. But yeah, it was tremendous. I mean, I've got no time for the Chinese state or the authorities or any of that. I'm not making any kind of leeway there. But it was a really exciting time. It was almost like if you'd imagined going back to America or Chicago at the end of the 19th century, do you know what I mean, and seeing that kind of urban development. It was, and it was polluted and it was wonderful. You never see it again in history. And then towards 2015, 16, 17, you could start to see this kind of bit more of a Xi Jinping clamp down on people's movements and free speech and what have you. And it became a bit unpleasant. So I thought I'd better get out. But that said, ordinary Chinese people, I have probably never had so many fascinating conversations with people who are, you know, because they are constrained under a authoritarian one-party state, that doesn't stop them being opinionated or pissed off with the way the world is working. So, you know, they are more than happy to chat about where everything is going wrong. The problem is they can't do anything about it because there is no mechanism for engagement in democratic politics or voting for anybody or any of that. So it's a very kind of frustrated political environment over there, but exciting for all of that.
So I assume you taught at this university in China.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, did you teach, obviously, I mean, you must have taught in English while you was over there with these people, you know, the Chinese people you taught, were they English speakers, fluent in English?
Fluent is probably too strong a word, but, you know, they had a good fist of it. I mean, I think my general, I taught in English. My Chinese was okay, but it couldn't handle proper teaching in that level. But Chinese students come in different shades, so the best students are beyond brilliant, and some of the best students I've seen anywhere in the world. Then you have this kind of middle ground, fair enough, and then some of the poor ones are just atrocious. And it was, I think, part of the scandal, I suppose, of China, but I've subsequently seen it happening in Western universities. So this was maybe like 10 years ago, and now it's happening over here, is that, you know, I would have a student, let's say, one student who I just knew was hopeless. I couldn't hold a pen, let alone design anything. And then, you know, he disappeared for 3 weeks, never came to any of my discussions, my tutorials, and then turned up for the final review with this beautiful model, these lovely drawings. So he paid $500 or whatever to get somebody to do them for him. So I said, you've failed. You're an idiot, right? That's not your work. But because the university sector, in any level, not just where I was, but every university, doesn't have, no, they want proof. If you criticize a student, everyone's now afraid that a student will say, how dare you accuse me? I'm going to sue you or whatever. Everybody's running scared. So because I had no proof, even though it was right in front of my eyes, he was passed. Yes. Actually you can see that a lot happening in Western universities, not just with Chinese students, but everybody is kind of, you can't tell whether somebody's colluded, whether somebody's cheated, whether somebody's gaming the system, because nobody wants to challenge anybody because it's a money machine now. Academia has lost its academic gloss, and it's become an industry, and it's a real tragedy.
Yeah,
I probably overstated that for the effect, but you get the gist.
Sure. You're not the only person I've spoken to who's come out of academia who's kind of jaded by the experience, or is not particularly optimistic about where it's headed.
I had black hair a couple of weeks ago. Yeah.
Well, is there anything that's common about sort of Chinese architecture that you find quite innovative, and you think perhaps the West would benefit from taking that approach? Is there anything that you'd take?
Well, I mean, historically, what I found fascinating about China, so like, you know, when China kind of broke from its imperial past back in the 1910s, 1920s, you had this kind of fantastic moment where China was becoming a new country and having its own national identity. Therefore, it wanted to become a player in the world. Yes, so this was the, you know, you've seen pictures of decadent Shanghai where, you know, people are dancing and singing the jazz age of China. It was a really fascinating decade, as it was in America, obviously, very decadent period. And so they had this kind of conflicted relationship where Chinese architects were discovering historical Chinese forms, you know, the kind of the famous like funny shaped roof in China and all that. So they were rediscovering their history and building this kind of new artificial replication of that history to say we are Chinese. Well, at the same time, they're also looking to Paris or New York or London and developing more modern, what we started with, a bit more concrete, brutal kind of plain buildings. So you had architects that were doing both of those things at the same time, which I don't think has ever happened anywhere in history before. You know, architects tend to have a style or a type or whatever you want to call it, and they will hammer it till it's, you know, until it's blue in the face. Whereas in China, they were really playing both sides of a coin. And, you know, it ended up being a really interesting mix within some of those urban areas back in the 1920s. You could see modern West and old-fashioned Chinese. So there's that was fine. Now you've got much more of Xi Jinping clamping down, and you have patriotism and nationalism materializing in a much less kind of, I don't know, flamboyant or open-minded way. And people are now having to hark back. You know, every time you see an architect in China, they'll talk about this kind of old style Shan Shui, which are like mountains and river ink drawings from the 16th century. And they'd all play these kind of nonsensical games of justifying their designs on the basis that it harks back to some ancient history back in China. So it's really sad. They don't have that confidence to challenge the system anymore. It seems to be kind of weighing down on them a little bit. That's going on. And then the second thing, sorry if I'm boring you with all this, but
no, go ahead.
There's also a shift towards rural reconstruction. So China has been urbanizing for the last 50 years. Yes. So I think 1975, there was about 17% urban. Now they're 65% urban. That's an amazing transformation. Yeah. Like 800 million people moving into cities in the last 50 years, twice, nearly two and a half times the population of America, right? Just become urban like that. By doing that, you know, they've developed their society. They have a new economic dynamism, but the rural areas are where many of those people came from to work. So they leave the villages and leave behind old people and young children. And there's a growing, or there has been a growing psychological problem of, you know, if you're 5, 6, 7 years old and you're growing up with an 80-90-year-old grandparents, great grandparents, that you don't have the same level of interaction or development. So it's been a bit of a problem for them. So they're now trying to recreate the reasons why people should stay in the rural areas. It's a kind of a inversion of what they've been doing for the last 50 years. Whether it's going to work or not, I have no idea. But it's a interesting experiment, tragic experiment, but really interesting. See how it works.
Keeping with this idea of kind of like the drab new kind of urban environments in the UK, I mean, do you look at, as an architect and with having that mindset, do you look at new builds and often cringe at the way they're kind of thrown together, or do you kind of long for a period of the, you know, Great Britain where things look differently and were constructed differently?
I cringe at most architecture. I mean, partly because I was an architect and then I became an architectural journalist. I say it was the greatest move of my life. So instead of people criticizing my rubbish, I could then criticize theirs. So it's a wonderful position to be in. But yeah, I mean, there's lots of nonsense and horrible stuff being built. But at the same time, there's good stuff. But I think there's this kind of inflated idea about British architecture as being, you know, the best in the world. And I no longer believe that's the case. I think you can look at Japan. Japan's doing some fantastic stuff. America does interesting stuff in the middle of like Central America, you know, center of America, rather than on the east and west coast. So there's lots of interesting stuff happening out there. It just very rarely gets the attention, and the big names still carry on, you know, flying the flag and getting all the credit. I don't think it's deserved much anymore. So, you know, it's about time there's a new generation came into the fore. Whether they've got the ability, the imagination, the innovation, the autonomy, the desire, or the general wit to be able to carry the can, I don't really know. So we'll see what happens. Interesting times ahead, as they say in China.
I mean, are we in this tiny little island? Are we kind of running out of space to build things? You mentioned obviously there's a lot of pre-World War One property out there that's kind of in disrepair. Are we eventually going to run out of places to build houses in the UK?
Well, Britain is even if you look at the worst case example, Britain is 11% urban. That means roads, pavements, housing, streets, backyards, right, wherever, right? That means like 90% is not. Now, I'm not suggesting we concrete over everywhere because we don't need to, but, you know, there's huge areas owned by King Charles that maybe could do with being developed. There's lots of kind of countryside, but also kind of lots of areas which are just fairly naff and bankrupt. So building a new city is fundamentally necessary, I think. Where that is, how that gets developed, what the conversation is around that, I don't really know. But you know that there's a, the problem is that we're now entering the era of the NIMBY and people who don't want any development at all, or especially anything near them. And I think that's something we have to confront. I think when we had the era we were talking about earlier, post-war, when the idea that if you were going to build infrastructure, people were right behind you. Now, if you're going to build the national grid and provide electricity to every home, that was such a positive vision. Nobody said, hang on, those pylons are really ugly. Why are they going down to the countryside? Whereas now, we only look at the pylons and say things are ugly. And we now don't understand the idea about social betterment and improvement.
All right, Austin. Well, we've just run out of time. This has been fascinating. Thank you for coming on and speaking to us about this. Maybe you could just point people towards where they could find out more of your work and journalism.
I'm on Future Cities as Future_Cities on Twitter. I got my link there to the website. I've written a couple of books. You can probably find out where I am if you're interested, I'm sure.
Thanks, Austin. It's been a pleasure.
Pleasure.
It's been a pleasure to speak to you.
Lovely talking to you, Stephen. Take care yourself.
Take care. Bye-bye now. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Interesting topic, architecture. Sean, welcome back.
Yeah, we were talking about that earlier, how they squeeze us by not building enough houses and keeping the prices high and keeping the wealth of the most rich people high.